So convolutional neural networks, and they're typically used for images, but can be used for other things. But Alexander, why don't you introduce it and share slides when you feel like it?
Yes, I will just begin immediately here. All right, so I assume you can all see the slideshow.
Yep.
All right, so I have the pleasure of talking about the convolutional neural networks. If you don't know, it's a type of neural network which works particularly well for image data. So just a brief overview. I'll just give a brief recap of artificial neural networks, as you have already heard about. Then we'll move over to speaking generally about how images are represented on a computer, only in relevance to how we will use them. And then we'll go through the overall architecture of CNNs and the building blocks of which it is made of. We'll only briefly look at the training process and inference, since you already know some of the steps here. And then we'll look at a simple implementation in Python and what to be aware of. Lastly, I'll just give two small examples of what CNNs can also be used for and give a bit of perspectivation. So, all right. So just a brief recap of artificial neural networks. It's a general model which we can use both in terms of supervised and unsupervised learning. So basically whether or not we have true labeled data. But the use cases are very general, so we can, besides classifications, which we will talk about today, also use them for regression and segmentation of images into various components. And even compression and noise reduction, and there are many, many use cases. So one thing to be aware of is that they are less interpretable compared to decision trees. So here we typically, in decision trees, we might not learn linear relations in data, and we have a very limited hypothesis space. But they are also not undergoing gradient descent. But instead, we make these attribute splits, which are very transparent, while the gradient descent is more of an analytical approach where we have some requirements of smooth functions which we want to optimize. So you might already have heard about this thing called a black box model, which it suffers from, but it is also sometimes misunderstood. So I will just briefly mention it. If you haven't heard, it refers to the fact that we have a lack of precise knowledge of what is going on inside. But this by no means means that it's impossible to find out. It's just very intractable. And this is because the learning process itself is a sequence of results from many different operations. And it can be very difficult to combine these understandings from these very different scales. So just a small analogy. Just like we can have a very precise model of a wave droplet, and we might know its motion and its energy. And we might also have a very, very nice large-scale model of the oceans and how everything flows. But combining these two understandings and synthesizing them can be a bit difficult. So yes, we can still use them, and yes, we know what is going on different levels. And we make sanity checks throughout such that we know that what is happening is actually reasonable and it is working as expected. But just like you don't have to know all the specifics about how electricity works to use a lamp, we can also use convolutional neural networks. But they might at times at least be surprisingly well behaving. So yes, that was just a brief mentioning. So let's move on to how we represent images on a computer. So you might already know this, but I will just mention some things which will be relevant for the later things we'll go through. So basically, an image is represented in a finite grid, which means that we have a finite resolution. So this puts already a limit on the precision with which we can do mathematical operations, or rather on which they can act. So an image can consist of multiple channels, which basically just expands the representation. This can be represented by different wavelengths. But the bitwidth and the data type we use also actually controls the dynamic range. By this, I mean that we have a finite representation of the contrast in an image. So the ratio with which we can differentiate between different edges and different parts. So for example, choosing a single bit, zero and ones, we get a black and white image, but no gray tones. While choosing, for example, an unsigned 8-bit integer, we have 256 values, which both include black and white, but also a lot of gray tones. And we can expand on this to multiple data types, which kind of extends or narrows down our range. But the contrast is also reflected by our choice of color map. And it is very important that we are not fooled by this tool, because it is simply just a mapping that can either be linear or nonlinear. And this means that it can highlight different regions in an image. But this does not mean that those regions are necessarily more important, because we can manipulate with how things are perceived by this simple mapping. So lastly, for things we will talk about soon, we typically normalize the values to be within a very narrow range. This could be the range 0 to 1, so a simple normalization. So this is good to keep in mind. All right, so the main operation which we will talk about is the convolution operation. So basically, it's a regional approach. And to boil it down to the core, it is basically just element-wise multiplication and summation. So the middle part here, called the kernel, that has multiple names, it is also called a filter. And each value within it is called a weight. So this area which it spans, it's called the receptive field of the filter. And we can see here that we basically center in on a value, and then we take a small window where each value from the filter weights is multiplied by some pixel elements, and then we do a sum to get one single scalar out again. So this is a very simple operation, which can be used in various ways. So first of all, I will give some examples of what it looks like to convolve an image with a kernel. So if we have a simple input image from the NIST dataset, a written digit dataset, which we will talk more about. This image is unsigned 8-bit integer. So we have 256 values to represent this 28 by 28 pixel input image. And here I have shown one of the typical filters. So this is called a Sobel filter in the X direction and in the Y direction. And basically what it is just a regional gradient. So you can think of the finite difference method, basically, which might be obvious from, if you again recall, that it's basically element-wise multiplication and summation, that we have a difference element between pixel values. So in the X direction, we can see that if black values correspond to high values numerically, then we get that the edges on the horizontal axis are highlighted. While if we use a DY filter, so in the Y direction, we don't have so many large activations on the horizontal direction, but more on the vertical one. And lastly, we can see here for a Gaussian filter, we can actually blur the image by representing, you might see that it kind of resembles a pyramid shape. So if you think of a two-dimensional Gaussian distribution where these values sum to 16, so we have a normalization in front, but we can see that we basically blur out the image. So again, very simple values, but convolved and windowed over the entire image, we get these results. And these are also called feature maps. All right, let's expand on this a bit. We use these convolutions to extract features from images, but we can also use them to manipulate images. So the features, just like we saw that we can blur an image, we can also enhance images or remove noise. But for CNNs, it is for at least classification and what we will talk about today, it is important to note that we extract various features. So it's a linear operator, but doesn't that limit our possible things to do with it? Well, First of all, nonlinear kernels or filters cannot be represented by convolution. And this is, again, due to the fact that we have a regional approach where we have element-wise multiplication and summation. So if you imagine a sliding window with replacing all the local values by the median, this is called a sliding median filter. And it's an example of a nonlinear filter where it cannot be replaced by any convolution operation. So just a small brief note, it is quite interesting to note that we are talking about convolutions in coordinate space right now. But just so you know, you can also do convolutions equally in frequency space by doing Fourier analysis. But this is not something we will focus on today, but it is definitely something used if you're working with convolutions. So we can generalize this single channel that I showed before for grayscale image to multiple dimensions and multiple channels. And besides defining the size of the window, we also define a parameter called the stride and the padding. So the stride basically tells us how much we move to the side to take the next window. So if we have a stride of one, just like for this example, then we would move one time to the right and then do the same operation again. And we can see that the image would reduce to a 4x4. Or actually, in this case, they haven't really indicated the pattern, so it might be a kind of a misleading image. But the important thing is here that since we have an RGB image in three channels, we also need to have a three channel filter or convolution. And these might or need not be the same values, because we might want to operate on the different channels in different ways. So generally, these values are what we want to train for. So we don't write them manually, but this is exactly what we want the network to learn. All right, so the padding basically makes sure that if we want to keep our image from shrinking, perhaps because we want a lot of consecutive layers, then we can pad with zero values around the image. We can even mirror the image. This is highly problem specific and what we want to do with our edge cases, but it is very important to do because pixels on the corners and on the edges, they are huge, used much less than pixels in the middle. So if we can pad things out, we also get the edges and corners represented equally. So typically what we use is a stride of one, and padding depends on whether or not we need to keep our image dimensions. So basically these kernels, filters, are used to extract both global and local context in the form of feature maps. So they allow us to represent our image in singled out features. A very important note, both for CNNs, but also the convolution operation in general, is that it commutes with translation. So when we have commutation, we have invariance, and we have translational invariance, which is a very nice and important property for CNNs, because we want to recognize features regardless of where they appear in an image. So this is very, very important and crucial to the success of convolutions. We, of course, don't want to be hindered by where any feature is placed in an image. All right, so if we zoom a bit out and look at the large-scale architecture of CNNs, we can see that on the bottom image here, we can roughly divide such a network for classification in this case, as being split up in two various phases. So the first one consists of a feature learning phase where we try to learn the various features which are present and prominent in the image. And then we have a classification part where we try to find patterns in all these features and trying to generalize them in order to be able to describe the content of the image. So throughout this process, the image representation becomes more abstract the dimensions might change, and we might not even see anything that resembles the input image after just a few layers. But we typically, for the feature learning part here, we categorize one layer by the sets of unique trainable parameters. So in this case, we have convolution and something called value, and also pooling. Typically, we would actually combine all of these to be called one layer, but that is just notation. So we often speak about the capacity of a network. And this is basically saying something about the complexity of the underlying patterns which can be learned by the network, or the ability of the network to learn these patterns. And this makes it such that we don't want to shrink our network too fast, because we might miss some features at specific scales, which cannot be found if we go on two small dimensions. But generally, we can keep in mind that the deeper we go, the higher capacity, but we also get many parameters. And this makes it such that it's not just a simple matter of making a network as deep as possible, because we need to be careful of overfitting and regularization. And often, if we have very deep networks, this also requires a lot of extra data, which in itself can be quite a problem. So one question you might ask is, why not use something more simplistic, such as perhaps thresholding for identifying various things? So CNNs are very, very good at tackling natural variance in data. So one example could be if you are trying to classify street signs. So these might have different sizes, different orientations, different contrasts, different illuminations and such. But if you're sitting in a car, for example, and you want to detect these, you want to get all the street signs and not just the ones that fit perfectly with your hard-coded approach model. So there are many cases to cover, and this is something that CNNs do very well. Yes, and also the converse of a deep network is a very shallow network with very few layers. So why do we even need convolutions? Well, first of all, we have, for convolving a set of images, we get many parameters, even for modest input sizes. And this happens simply when we try to describe images in terms of individual features. Images are typically complex in their nature, and there are many interesting things which characterize the content of the image itself. So we make these convolutions and produce individual feature maps, which capture the context of the image. And each filter, besides the weights that we looked at before, also has a bias term, which is just a single scalar associated to it. So one filter, no matter the size of the depth, has a single bias term to it. So if we would introduce, say, three bias terms for a RGB or a three-channel filter, this would basically, in the end, just sum up to one single scalar anyway. So common sizes for these filters, just to give you an idea, it's typically an uneven size, which is rather small. So we would choose 3x3, 5x5, or 7x7 window sizes. And the reason why we want something uneven is that we can define a center value first of all, more precise when we choose our other parameters, so we know how it will behave, such as the striding padding. But what happens if we choose a too large convolution? Well, first of all, if we choose a too large convolution, we get a representation which might not be very useful for individual features. And if we go too small, we also end up with the possibility of, what does a one-by-one filter even mean? Well, for a single depth channel, this might seem trivial, but actually, if you have a larger input size, which will be the case in layers, then it is basically trying to summarize the information throughout the whole depth. So it is a one-by-one by n vector, which tries to extract or reduce the number of feature channels in the input and tries to reduce it for its output. So generally, we have, I did mention for the bias term, that what it ensures and the reason why we want it in the first place is that it can make sure that the output of neurons can be non-zero, even though the kernel output at a region is zero. So we want to keep all the various areas of an image alive, meaning that we want a non-zero activation, such that when we do our backpropagation, we don't have dead areas and dead zones. So yes, throughout, like I mentioned, we have weight sharing, which means that one gradient when doing backpropagation can affect multiple or multiple gradients can affect a single kernel. So it is not an isolated example, but it looks in various ways. Like I mentioned, the deeper we go, the more specific our features get. So if we initially have, say, edges and corners and very simple features, just like the ones I showed with the Sobel filter in the D and in the X and Y direction, we, for later layers, have more specifics. So this can be more abstract concepts. For face recognition, it could be more specific features like the eyes and small details. Yes. So just to keep you a bit awake this morning, I have two very short questions, which you can just take a minute to think about. So the first one is, if you are given an input image of 28 by 28, just like the number 3 we saw before, and we perform a convolution with a window of size 5 by 5, and we do a single line of zeros padding around and a stride of 1, so we move 1 pixel at a time, what will the dimensions of the output become? And the second question is, if we have a single convolution layer and we feed a 3-channel image to it, and we have 8 kernels which are convolved on this input, all of them size 5 by 5, what will the final number or the total number of trainable parameters be for this layer?
Yep, Christopher came with a shot at the first one. Other opinions are welcome, and shots at the second one. Perhaps wait 2 minutes with answering the second one in the chat, just to let people think about what the, what does this give? And, well, we didn't make a poll this time, but rather I'd like you all to write the answer to question 2 in the chat, but don't press enter yet. All right? And then on a count to 3, we'll press enter. All right? 1, 2, 3. Go. Either my connection is slow or all right, now we have a few shots at it.
All right,
Alexander, tell us how to think.
All right, so I will just start by showing the answer, and we can just talk about it here. So it's correct like Christopher said, that it's 26 by 26. So we basically subtract the size of the filter from the input size, and then we add 2 times the padding for each side of the image, dividing by the stride, and then adding 1 for the offset that we get by the centering pixel. So this correctly responds to 26 by 26. But for the second one, I can see that the answer 600, and this is I believe because the bias term also needs to be added. So just like I mentioned, each filter, no matter its depth, but one filter has one corresponding bias term associated to it. So here, although we have 3-channel kernels, we have 8 of them, and this corresponds to 8 bias terms. So yes, the filter size squared times the number of input channels times the number of kernels that we convolve with plus the bias terms, and N and B are equal. All right. So before I jump to the next part, I just want to show you a nice 3D visualization in order to perhaps keep it in the back of your mind, because I think it will make your understanding much easier. So here I have shown interactive CNN model, which is trained on the handwritten NIST dataset. And if I up in the corner here draw the number 3, just like our example before, we can see that we get a whole network generator here. And I think it's a pretty cool tool to get some intuition. So on the bottom here, we can see our input image, which I have drawn. And if I move the mouse over, I can see how all the different features are convolved from the input to give these different activations, where we can see that various features from the number 3 are highlighted. This is kind of like a 45 degree gradient in one direction, while this is a 45 angle gradient in another direction. And this actually corresponds to our DX Sobel filter from before. So very large scale patterns that the network has found, and which are actually necessary to identify or differentiate between numbers. So if we draw a different number, we get different activations, but many of the activations are quite similar, such as the large scale ones that we talked about here, the edges. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I definitely think that you should try this. I will link to it later. All right, let's jump back to the slides.
You can just tell me the link and I'll put it on the webpage. I've seen
it. I actually have it on the last slide.
Okay, cool.
I just wanted to tease it a little bit such that you can have it in the back of your mind, because I think it's a wonderful visualization. All right. So what happens after the convolution part, just like we saw on the figure before, we often follow this by a pooling layer. So this pooling operation has no parameters by itself, no trainable parameters, but what it does is it reduces dimension and unfortunately also the localization accuracy, but it's not necessarily a bad thing. It, on the contrary, makes our feature maps more manageable. So small representation here, we can see that different variations of pooling exist. So here we have a 2x2 window, which is the typically used size. And we can either only keep the maximum value, or we can do an average, we can do a median, we can do many sorts of things. But typically in CNNs, what we use is max pooling. And this decreases the localization, but it keeps what is most prominent, which is in fact what we are after anyway. So while convolution focuses a lot of, on context, this focuses more on trying to sort these things out and keeping what is most important. And it operates on each activation map individually. And we actually don't lose that much information as you might think, because you have to remember that the values in our feature maps, they cannot be singled out, but they actually represent the accumulation of all the previous processes that the input for this specific layer has gone through. So if we want to know a specific feature is present in an image, meaning it gets a high activation value at the convolution, then the exact location of this feature is not as important as its relative location to other features, which is still preserved for this operation. So I mentioned the word activation a couple of times, and this is one of the very crucial operations to convolutional neural networks, because as I mentioned before, convolutions are linear, and this would mean otherwise that we would only be able to do linear mappings on our data, which is quite boring. So while we have these various functions that you can see to the right here, I have plotted the functions themselves on the top image and their derivatives on the bottom. So previously, it was very, very common to see the hyperbolic tangent and the sigmoid function, which have some very nice smooth properties. But if for CNN specifically, then the ReLU or the rectified linear unit is most commonly used. And this is both due to computational efficiency, because it is a very, very simple mathematical operation. For positive values, we map a value to itself. So we can see the value 1 here maps to 1, and such we have a linear relation here. While for negative values, we simply map everything negative to 0. So quite a simple operation. And it is also, besides being computationally efficient, it is maintaining whatever accuracy is within the network. So it has shown to be a very promising approach for CNNs. So monotonicity is not a necessary thing for activation functions, but it can help speed up the optimization. And we often want to choose functions which are cheaply to differentiate and easy to implement due to how we use them in backpropagation, which you have already been hearing about, and I won't talk about this today. But one issue to keep in mind is that we can experience a saturated gradient problem, where if we are stuck on the tails of these distributions, our gradients are very small, and this makes positive or constructive increments in backpropagation very slow. So one thing is that exponentially the gradient can decrease throughout the layers, and this is something that the various activation functions deal with differently. All right. So one of the last layers that we saw on the classification CNN on one of the first slides included the classification path at the end. So these layers are fully connected, meaning that each neuron is connected to each other neuron in the next input. And this is more like a typical feed-forward artificial neural network, where the number of parameters that we have, although we already have many parameters for the convolution layers, the numbers in the dense layers increase drastically. So we flatten our inputs, and then we try to find patterns amongst all these various features which we have found by convolution. And sometimes it can be actually most often important and necessary to do randomized dropout to avoid that specific features or specific patterns will dominate the output, which will be the classification. We have no shared parameters between these dense layers, and they are typically found towards the end, but by no means are they necessary for CNNs. This is very important, because we can definitely have fully convolutional neural networks with no dense layers at all. This is something that you would see perhaps in variational autoencoders or segmentation networks, where we are not necessarily interested in classifying anything, but we want to use these features for different purposes. All right. So the last dense layer in a classification network needs to have the number of nodes corresponding to the number of classes that we want to map finally to. So how do we choose an architecture, and what do we need to consider? Well, just like general machine learning approaches, you don't have one-fits-all models, but we can look at the capacity of a network combined with our specific data and specific problem at hand, and try to get a sense of what we can learn with a given architecture. And we control this through various hyperparameters, and we look at how, for example, we want to monitor how our kernel values change throughout the training process. So typically we would initialize them by perhaps a Gaussian distribution or a uniform distribution, and then throughout the epochs and the iterations, so an epoch is a full forward and backward propagation again throughout the network, and we sort of follow by plotting how the various distributions change, because if we have random changes in each direction or we have nothing happening, then we are not increasing the capacity of our network, but we are simply just blindly trying to do random things. And like I mentioned before, just like dropout, we can also have pruning, where we try to make our network simpler, which can tremendously increase our performance. And just a quick, small, fun note. It seems in neuroscience that it is something that is actually also happening in our brains, where we, at a very young age, we peak in the number of connections we have in our brain, and then we get fewer connections. So we also have some sort of like intrinsic pruning, and this can be very good in the CNN case to be better to generalize to some data and prevent co-adaptation with overfitting to seeing some specific feature constellations. So we often don't feed a single image to the network, but work in mini batches, which ideally should represent the whole data set as such. And we use this as an approximation to do our gradient descent. But generally, what we need to do is try different things out, because one place changing a thing in one place can make changes in other parts of the network redundant. So we have some specific things which I will show on next slide what we can do, but it is important to know that there is not one golden recipe which we can use. But typically what we need to do is, just like I showed on the initial image, we have constrained our values to be in a short, narrow range, either by normalization or standardization, where we center our data to have zero mean and unit variance. And this is simply done such that we can be sure that small perturbations in our weights and biases also yield small changes in the output, because otherwise optimization is not even possible if a small tweak gives unreasonably large changes in the network. So one good approach to training a network would be to start with a very tiny portion of data, and you should be able to do very well on this data and easily overfit. So you can monitor various parameters during training and do adaptations accordingly. So start with very coarse changes, and then later on you can fine tune. Throughout, like I mentioned, make sanity checks. Is the network behaving as you expect? So is the loss behaving as you expect? And can you intentionally make the model worse by doing some specific changes? So you get like a feeling of if the networks are responding as you intend. An interesting thing is that instead of doing a very fine grid search over the parameter space, since we often deal with highly dimensional data but have a effective lower dimensionality, then it can actually be more constructive to do a randomized search where we statistically would get more samples for the interesting part instead of doing like a fixed grid search over our very large parameter space. Also, besides initializing our weights ourselves, We can actually start from the output of a state-of-the-art network and take all the learned weights, feed them into our network, and then start our training from there if we want to use it for perhaps an extension. All right, so implementing this in Python is done through a highly parallelized process. We train on GPUs because we can simply characterize these networks in parallel operations through vectorization. Again, we don't use a single image, but small batches. And if we don't have enough data for perhaps very deep networks, we need to do data augmentation. So adding artificial data, which should ideally represent new unseen data. But sometimes we need to be careful. So we can do rotations and scaling, but for numbers, for example, like the written digit data set, if we have labeled data for sixes and nines, and we do rotations on them, and we still keep the label, then we actually confuse our network because it cannot any longer differentiate between those two representations. I will briefly show you right now an implementation using TensorFlow, but you can also use PyTorch, and TensorFlow and PyTorch are amongst the more popular choices for working with CNNs. And you get a large degree of freedom in choosing whether you want a high level or low level approach in both frameworks. All right, so I will quickly shift to a Jupyter notebook, which is also uploaded on the website. And we will just go through it very coarsely here to give you an idea of how to work with all these things that we have been talking about. So firstly, we are so lucky that a lot of generic data sets exist in libraries like TensorFlow and PyTorch. So here we load our NIST data set with handwritten digits, and Trollset also uploaded a link to both this data set and also different data sets on the same web page. If you want, we can train on the GPU, but for this purpose, I have already run the whole code, so we will just see how it works in general steps. We do our general splits, like you already know, in training, validation, and test. I have standardized the data sets. This is a choice, just to show you that, again, we need to not use any specific values from our training or our test set, any statistics intrinsic to it, such that we ensure our unbiased estimates of our model performance. We define the number of classes, use one-hot encoding for our classes or our labels. After loading the data, we just make a sanity check, check that all the dimensions are as they need to be. So TensorFlow likes formatting in the number of samples and height and width and number of channels. And we have the labels here, one hot encoded. And we have 60,000 training images, 8,000 validation, and 2,000 for testing. So we just plot them to verify that they look as they should and that our labels are correctly placed. And this looks fine. So we also check for any unbalanced data, and we see that we have approximately uniform distributions. But if some numbers were represented in an unbalanced manner, we would need to deal with this, of course, just like any other machine learning algorithm. Here we create our model in a sequential fashion. And this is a very high-level library. So very easily, we can define a relatively complex but shallow network. So we define 32 kernels in the first convolution layer, all by 3x3 sizes with a stride of 1. And padding same means that we don't change the dimensions of the output. So we pad accordingly, such that if we get 28x28 in, that is also what comes out before booming. We activate by the rectified linear unit, then we do pooling, 2x2 windows, then we have another set of convolution in a 64 deep layer, and then we do pooling again. We make dropout where we randomize 40% chance of a neuron being deactivated. Then we flatten everything, and we feed it into a 128 long dense layer, also with a rectified linear unit activation. And then we scale it down to 10 neurons, our number of classes, and then we run it through the softmax to get some probabilities out. So here we can see the number of parameters, and by the formula we saw before, you can calculate that this actually makes sense. And we can see the shapes throughout the network here. So we have already for this modest network 420,000 parameters to train for. This is a lot. So I have run this for 5 epochs, and we can see that we actually get a very good performance, but that is expected for the NIST dataset, which is relatively straightforward in this case for a CNN at least. If we try to inspect all the learned kernels, I just wanted to show you that it can be done, and I definitely think that you should try to extract some of these kernels and try to manually convolve them on the image at various stages to see what these learned features or these learned kernels actually represent and what they are trying to find. So evaluating our training process, we get 99.2% accuracy already for such a modest network, although with many, many parameters. Doing inference, we can see that this is also very easily done, and this is an operation which is almost instantaneous on our trained network, because again, we just need to multiply and add throughout, something which a computer is very fast at doing. To just give a sense of the performance in terms of the specific images, we do a plot of the confusion matrix. And we see that what is typically misclassified are the elements on the off diagonals. So we can see here that, for example, we predicted the number 3 when the number was actually a 5, 3 times. Out of the 15 total wrong predictions we had on our test set. And we also had some 8s, which should have been 3s. And we might see how these resemble one another. So let's try to inspect the predictions. So the correct predictions are all fine here. And we can see that the numbers are quite clear for the human eye. But what about the wrongly predicted images? Well, here we can see, for example, like I mentioned, we predicted an 8, but it was actually the number 3. But we can see even for the human eye, this is not really the most beautifully drawn number 3. So even a human might be a bit offset by this. And luckily, we can do a sanity check and see that most, if not all, of the numbers that are wrongly predicted are actually somewhat non-typical, at least. So for example, this 6, and this, which has been predicted as an 8, but it's actually a 9, is one of the more common ones. This is something which should be very easily to eliminate, because as my final note says here, this is a very simple and crude model. And by using a proper CNN with more analysis and a bit better approach, you should expect to get even better results. So above 99.6 should definitely be doable for very good networks.
If I may interrupt you there. Yeah. I can say that, first of all, it was among others, but Corina Cortes, who's a Danish computer scientist, now leader of Google in New York, the research there. She was one who put together this data set. And Jan LeCun is one of the gods, I would say. And that's why I linked to his webpage, because you can see the number of solutions through time and how good they are on his webpage. And mm-hmm. It's fun to see how... you know, it's not that many years ago that getting this result was not possible, but now it's trivial and simple. Then Andy has a good question. So down in the chat, he asks, why is validation loss smaller than training loss? I would always expect the opposite. If you go back to your Jupyter Notebook, share again so we can see it.
Yes. All right.
So the validation loss.
Yes.
Is
so we can see here that it's 99.2, and our inference is a bit higher, but by a very, very small factor. So this network, as I also mentioned, is a very crude model, and it is mostly also to show that with very few steps, the strong structure of these CNNs and the feature extraction can provide very good results, but stuff like overfitting and doing, like I mentioned lastly, a proper implementation would definitely avoid some of these issues. But I think it's a very good point, like Tols mentioned, that just a couple of years ago, this kind of performance was not possible. And we can see how CNNs for even very, very crude and naive models like the ones I have showed here can actually get quite a good performance. But definitely, this is a sign of adaptations needed to the approach, definitely.
Yeah. It's also fun to see that it's very few epochs. I mean, don't expect things to work in five epochs.
No. Also a very good point, yes. So typically we would run these for real-world data for hundreds and hundreds of epochs, sometimes even in the thousands. But this network ran in about 2 minutes or 2.5 minutes. And it was, again, just a very, very crude model. And also 420,000 trainable parameters is actually not that much for CNN. So one of the points with this was also just to show with how simple of a network that CNNs are really, really good at identifying features. And okay, fair enough. The MNIST dataset is also a relatively easy dataset because we don't have such a high complexity. We often have, or we only have one single number per image, and still the CNN with such a short training time can identify most of the relevant parameters. But we can also see, like I mentioned lastly here, so this, which is a number 9 and was predicted as a number 8, this looks easy enough that the network should have caught up on this. So again, this is obviously showing that the network's capacity is not good enough. But a very good point.
It's fun. Here we ask it, if you go back to the numbers, we ask it to give it, to say which number is it. But in reality, what it has is a score for each. And you would, in the 9 case there, expect it to have a reasonably high score for both 8 and 9. It just happened to have a higher score for 8. And so it predicted that. You might want to exclude those where you have two competing scores. Mm-hmm. But that's all up to those who run whatever network it is. And then I think another point is the time that it takes is, 2.5 minutes for these images, but they're tiny and the network is tiny. So before you find 1,000 images and just run on that with a large network, get access to GPU and even then be patient. Mm-hmm. It's still a thing that requires a lot of computing power, just to let everybody know.
Very good point, yes.
Cool. You know what? I think we should... it's great that you put up this exercise, Alexander, and thanks a lot. I think we should take a break of at least 15 minutes, and then we will return, and I think we should go through the code sort of a little more, think about the different parts, and then let people play with it and see if they can get any higher. But with 2.5 minute running time, there's sort of a limit to how many times you can run it between now and the end of the exercise. But let's start by a 15 minute break. We go stretch your legs, get tea and coffee, and we'll reconvene at 10:30. Good.